It had snowed overnight.
Brown stubble poked through the white blanket covering the garden. I pushed the snow from the top step. I set the loaf down, knocked on the door, and ran. The next day I came back to look. The bread was gone. That was how it started. 10. From then on, I tried to snatch 2 loaves each day. I would save 1 for Uri and me, and leave the other on the back step of Janina's house. One time I looked up and saw her staring at me from the back window. She smiled. I smiled. I began to find things on the step where I left the bread. I found a gum drop and a candy cigarette and a fancy button. I always looked at the window, but she was never there again. One day I left the bread and picked up a little black and white glass dog no bigger than my thumbnail. I was fascinated. I walked off, staring at the tiny dog, turning it over in my fingers. I was almost home. We were living in a stable loft then, when suddenly I turned and ran back to the house. It was in my mind to pound on the door to make her come out so I could say something to her. When I got there, someone was at the step. A boy. He turned and saw me. He stuffed the bread into his coat and ran. I ran after him, shouting, "Stop, thief!" I caught up to him. I grabbed his long black coat, but he kept on running. He was a shoulder and head taller than me. I was his tail. I tripped and let go. I ran after him again. We dodged in and out of people. They did not seem to notice us. Suddenly he turned. I ran into his fist. Next thing I knew, I was in the gutter. Pinpricks of frozen rain were falling. There was something hard in my mouth. I spit it out. It was a tooth. I reached into my pocket. The glass dog was smashed. At home, Uri's eyes bulged when he saw me. "What happened to you?" I told him. "You're too little to fight," he said. "You don't fight. You run." He cleaned me up. He wiped blood from my face and ears and neck. When he touched my face, it hurt. He kept muttering, "Stupid, stupid." Next time I wasn't stupid, I went at night. There was no one on the streets. I wondered where the people were. The streetlights were like moons cupped in iron fingers. Behind Janina's house, there was no light at all. I ran my hand across the step. I felt something. I put it in my pocket. I put the bread on the step. I looked up at the window, but it was even darker than the night. Somewhere in the house, Janina was sleeping. I waved at the dark, empty window and went away. Back on the street, I heard a shout. I turned. Someone stood up the street in shadow. He stepped into the light. I heard a pop, saw a flash, felt a tug on my ear. I reached up. I couldn't feel my earlobe. Someone was shooting at me. I ducked into the nearest air shaft and made my way home along the alleyways. My ear hurt. I cried. Uri came to me. When I told him what had happened, he flicked his cigarette lighter to see. He smacked me and stuffed a rag against my ear. "Stupid. Stupid." "I can't find my earlobe," I told him. "They shot it off," he said.
"Who?"
"The jackboots. Who do you think?" "Why did the jackboots shoot my ear?" "Because of the curfew." "What's the curfew?" I said. He turned off the cigarette lighter. He was a voice in the black. "Curfew means all Jews off the streets after dark."
"But I'm not a Jew."
"If they shoot at you, you're a Jew. I told you not to go out at night. You don't listen." He flicked on the lighter, smacked me again, and flicked off the lighter. It was true. He had told me. It was also true that I didn't listen. I had sneaked out while he slept. To show him I understood, I smacked myself. Before I went to sleep, I remembered my pocket. I pulled out the thing I had found on Janina's step. Feeling it, I could tell it was a hair bow. I guessed it was red, the one she had worn on her birthday. I put it in a bread bag where I kept all the things she left on the step. The next day, Uri tied a rope around my wrist. "Teach you a lesson," he said. We went off to meet the boys. We met them in a cemetery. They laughed when they saw me.
"He's on a leash. Bow wow.
Toss him a bone.
Look, he was in a fight with another dog. It bit his ear off. Let him alone,
Uri said.
Let me alone,
I said. I have 7 brothers and 5 sisters. They laughed even louder, but they left me alone. There was smoke blowing Ferdi and Oleg with one arm, and grim-faced Inas, and the rest of them. But there was no pile of treasures anymore, and there were no cigars, and no one threw food about. But there were cigarettes. Ferdi pulled a handful from his pocket, and everyone lit up, even me. It was my first cigarette.
He's smoking, exclaimed Kuba, who was a clown. He'll stunt his growth. How can he? He's already smaller than a cockroach.
And then Kuba, the clown, charged into one-armed Oleg. The two of them wrestled, but it was no match. Oleg was much better with 2 legs than Kuba with 2 arms. Oleg had Kuba wrapped like an octopus, Kuba squealing and flailing. Kuba grabbed Ferdi's leg and bit it. Ferdi screamed. And in a moment, everyone but Uri and grim-faced Inas was on the ground, even me with my leash. We laughed and bit and wrestled, and I think we must have looked like one squirming creature with many heads, arms, and legs. At last we peeled apart and flopped to the ground, exhausted and laughing. My ear was bleeding again and hurting. I pressed a fistful of dry grass to it. Except for Kuba, we sat on the ground and talked and laughed and smoked our cigarettes. But that didn't last long, as the frozen ground was even colder than the air. One by one we stood. We milled about, we bumped into each other and grappled. We made a game of giving and receiving bear hugs, to see who was strongest, we said. But I think it was to be close. In the cemetery, our bodies were the only fires. Some of us played hide-and-seek among the tombstones. I was it, and when I went seeking, I came upon a tombstone such as I had never seen before. Rising up from a great block of stone was a man with wings. He was looking at the sky, as if he might fly off at any moment. I couldn't take my eyes away. "Hey, gypsy!" came a voice. "Come on, we're hiding!" But I just stood there, staring up at the great stone man with wings. Soon others were standing by. "Who is he?" I said. "It's an angel," said Ferdi. "What's an angel?" I said. Grim-faced Inas said, "There are no angels." I looked at him. I pointed to the man with wings. "So what is that?"
"Just stone," he said. "It's not real. It's something jackboots believe."
"I believe," said Oleg. He scratched the stump of his missing arm. "There are angels. You just can't see them."
"Why not?" I said. "Are they hiding?"
"They're invisible."
I looked around. I had to agree. If they were there, they were invisible, all right, which made it especially good to have a stone statue of one. At least I could see that.
"What do they do?" I said.
"They don't do horseflop," said Inas. "They help people," said Oleg. "When you're in trouble, they help you out of it."
Inas snorted. He ground out his cigarette on the foot of the stone angel. "Where were they when you got pushed to the tracks and the train ran over your arm?" He grabbed the empty sleeve of Oleg's missing arm and flapped it in his face. "Where were your angels then? Why didn't they roll you off the tracks? Why didn't they stop the train?" He pointed at a boy called Big Henrik. His shoes were bank coin bags. "Look at him. Why don't the angels give him shoes or brains to want them? And him," jabbing his finger at John, who was thin and gray and never spoke. "Look at him. He's dying, and he doesn't even know it." Inas was shouting now. "What are your angels doing for him?" He spit on the stone angel. All was silent until the cry, "Jews!" came skimming over the tombstones. We turned to look. A black wagon was coming down the path. The lumbering horse wore a black shawl over its mane. A line of people, black-shawled and lumbering like the horse, followed the wagon. It was a small wagon, a cart, just big enough to hold a coffin. A man was shaking his fist.
"Jews! Hooligan Jew boys filthing up the cemetery!"
Several of the men left the line and headed toward us, shouting. We flung our cigarettes and ran. My leash flapped wildly, slapping tombstones. Suddenly Kuba stopped. He turned his back to the men, dropped his pants, and bent over and gave them a good long look. The running men shouted louder, but no louder than we laughed. In the stable that night, in the straw-smelling darkness, I said to Uri, Is Enos right? There are no angels? There was no answer. Are you sleeping?
I'm trying to, came his voice. Your silly questions. How do I know? Enos is whatever you want him to be. You want him to be right?
No, I said. I want him to be wrong.
Fine, he's wrong.
I want to believe in angels, I think.
Fine, believe.
But Enos says angels are for jackboots.
You're a jackass, that's what you are, and a silly one.
You don't say I'm stupid anymore, now I'm silly.
Take your pick.
But I'm not a jackboot. How can I believe in angels?
When you're nothing, you're free to believe anything. Go to sleep, Misha.
I tried to go to sleep, but a question kept nagging me. Uri?
He snarled. What?
Do you believe in angels?
I believe in bread, he said. Now shut up, or I'll come over there.
I shut up.
11. As if heeding Uri's words, bread soon became something more to believe in than to eat. One day I went to my usual spots, street corners near bakeries. These were the best. I waited at the first. No one came along with a bread bag. In fact, no one even came out of the bakery. I went to the next spot. Same thing. All day I went from corner to corner. Nothing. Not a single loaf of bread did I see. I did something I almost never did. I entered a bakery. It was a bakery with a yellow star painted on the window. I was shocked. On the shelves, against the wall, there was no bread at all. Only a single sad round roll. Behind the glass in the case were two or three cupcakes. The baker came from the back room.
You want to buy something?
He growled. I stared at the roll. It was better than nothing. But it was too high for me to reach. My speed and quickness were useless. I showed him my yellow stone.
Trade?
I said. I would not have given it to him. I just wanted to trick him into taking down the roll. His face turned red. He jabbed at the door.
Out! Get out of here, you little thief!
He reached for me, but I was gone. Back in the stable, I said to Uri, there's no more bread.
Learn to eat pickles, he said.
I did. I learned to eat a lot of things.
If there was no food on the streets, under the arms of the ladies in the fox-face furs, I went to the shops. If the shelves of the shops were bare, I went to the homes. There was always food in the homes, especially the large, fine houses, the houses that the ladies of the fox-face furs went back to. I had to be patient. It was hard to find an unlocked door. I learned to look for little children playing outside a large, fine house. When they went back inside, they often forgot to lock the door. In I walked, sometimes right behind the child. Some children looked back at me and said, "Who are you?"
"Misha Pilsudski," I said.
Some children said nothing. They seemed to think that if I strolled in the door with them, I must belong. I walked straight to the dining room or the kitchen. What happened then depended on who and where the people were. If there were only children, I might say, "Where are the cookies?" or "Where's the candy?" If there were grown-ups about, I grabbed the first thing I saw and ran. If there was no one or a very young child, I would take my time shopping in the kitchen. One time I entered a house through an unlocked back door. I heard voices and laughter. I moved through the kitchen and suddenly found myself standing in a doorway, staring at a family of people having dinner around a long table. Food and silver and glass sparkled everywhere. In the middle was a great golden roasted bird, perhaps a goose or turkey. I must have surprised them, for all movement stopped as they stared at me while I stared at the table. But not for long. As always, I was the first to move. I believed this was the first rule of life that I learned, though it was a twitch in my muscles rather than a thought in my head.
Always be the first to move. As long as that happened, they would have to catch up, and I could not be caught. I snatched the bird by the leg and bolted from the back door before they were out of their seats. Of course, I could not do this more than once at any one house. but there were many large, fine houses in Warsaw. Uri tied me to his own wrist when we went to sleep, so I could not deliver food to Janina in the night. During the day, I left things on the back step, a jar of jam, a drumstick. But I could never be sure they were not stolen. When the bread started to go, so did the trees. I heard them going early one morning. I felt the night leash tug on my wrist. I joined Uri at the window of the loft. Outside, men were standing knee-deep in snow, chopping down trees. "Why are they chopping trees?" I said. "Firewood," he said. "People are running out of coal. They're cold." Wherever we went looking for food, we heard the sounds of hatchets and saws and trees. Some trees fell with an almost silent whomp into the pillow of snow. Some gave a groan. Some shrieked in protest. One, a thick, burly monster of a tree with warts, came down with a high, thin wail that sounded exactly like a baby crying. Soon the parks were nothing but dry grass and stumps. One day, Uri went off by himself and came back with a sack of coal. "Black pearls," he said. He took the black pearls to Dr. Korchak to keep the orphans warm. The next day I too went searching for black pearls. I scrounged deep into the rubble of collapsed buildings, tunneling for coal bins. I found a piece here, a piece there, but it was mostly coal dust. When my sack was finally full, I marched to the orphanage and rapped with the brass knocker. An orphan boy came to the door. His mouth dropped open. His eyes bulged when he saw me. I blurted, "I'm not an orphan. I have 7 brothers and 5 sisters." I held out the sack. He ran. In a moment, Dr. Korchak appeared. Again, I held out the sack. "Black pearls," I said. "Keep you warm." His great white mustache stretched in both directions, and he laughed. "You," he pointed to me, "are the black pearl." He disappeared from the doorway. He returned with a mirror. "Look!" A face, black as coal itself, stared back at me. I never knew eyes were so white. It looked at the rest of me, my hands, my clothes. I was a walking lump of coal. "I'm black," I said. He laughed again. "Not for long." He took the sack of coal and led me into the house. He waved his arm. "Welcome to our wonderful home." Soon I was in something called a bathtub, and a lady on her knees was scrubbing me with a brush and soap. And as I became white again, and my stone became yellow again, the water became as black as jackboots. In distant rooms I heard laughter and the sound of running feet. I felt orphan eyes on me, but I could not see anyone. Dr. Korchak brought me new clothes, the second person ever to do that. As I put them on, he said, "So, little sack of warmth, I think you are a gypsy, am I right?" "Yes," I told him. "I used to be stupid, but now I'm silly." He laughed. He laughed a lot.
"Who told you that?"
"Uri," I said. "Uri is my friend. Do you believe in angels?" He stopped laughing. He stared at me. "Yes, I do believe in angels."
"So do I,"
I said, deciding once and for all. "Uri believes in bread." He nodded. "Yes, I believe in bread too." He was always smiling. His mustache made it seem a double smile. "What is your name, little man?"
"Monsieur Pilsudski,"
I said proudly. His eyebrows went up. "Ah, yes." He nodded and closed his eyes. "He's heard of me," I thought. "Misha Pilsudski." He seemed to be tasting my name. "Tell me, Misha Pilsudski, where do you live?"
"In the stable," I said,
"with Uri, but the horses are gone. And tell me, do you happen to be an orphan, Misha Pilsudski?" I loved his goatee even more than his mustache. It was so soft and white. I wanted to rub my face in it. I wanted to climb inside it and live there and peek out. I think he wanted me to be an orphan very badly. I hated to disappoint him. "Oh, no," I said. "I have 7 brothers and 5 sisters, and a mother and father and a great-great-grandmother who's 109 years old, and a horse named Greta, if I can ever find her." I told him how we had been bombed by jackboots and the whole story. Then Dr. Korchak left me waiting for a few minutes. When he returned, he led me to the great front room. I was amazed. There they were, the orphans, orphan boys and orphan girls, all of them standing at attention in rows from wall to wall. Dr. Korchak snapped his fingers, and everyone said at once, "Thank you, Misha Pilsudski." I was uncomfortable. I didn't know what to say. Dr. Korchak shook my hand and opened the front door for me. "Come see us again," he said. I walked away in my new clothes. 12. I continued to bring black pearls to Dr. Korchak and the orphans. To Janina's back step, I brought black pearls and bread when I could. I began to notice that there was no longer a gift waiting for me. One day I knocked on the back door. A man answered. I knew he was a jackboot even in his socks. His gray and silver jacket was unbuttoned, showing a stained T-shirt and suspenders. In one hand was a stein of beer. "Where's Janina and her family?" I said. He growled something at me in jackboot language. His breath was oniony. I repeated forcefully, "Janina!" He took a swig of beer. He pointed at the bag of coal in my hand. I held it out. "Black pearls," I said, "for Janina." He snatched them from me. He pointed at me, "Yuda!" That word I knew. "No," I said, "I'm a gypsy." He cocked his head as if to hear better. I stood at attention. "Gypsy!" He raised his hand. I thought, he's going to salute me, but he didn't. He slapped me and overturned the stein of beer onto my head. I snatched the bag of coal back from him. I swung the bag and brought it down with all my might onto his stockinged foot. He yowled. I ran. One morning, after awakening in our stable, as I was walking to the stall where we peed, I saw a man in another stall. He was curled up like a bean. He wore a long black coat. He lay in the straw. I squatted down beside him. Suddenly, one eye opened and stared at me. He sat up. "Do you live here?" I said. Straw poked from his head like extra hair. "I live nowhere," he said. "I live here with my friend Uri," I told him. "Do you want to live with us?" He looked around as if there was something he could not find. He shrugged. "Maybe." "Did you once live in a big house?" I said. I was thinking of Janina. "The house was big," he said, "but I only lived in two rooms." "With your children?" He looked at me. "With my books." I studied his face. "You're not a Jew, are you?" I said. His eyes shifted. He sat up straighter. "Why do you ask?" "You don't have a beard." He stood. He peered into the next stable. "That's because I'm not Jewish. Did someone tell you to ask?" "No." He repeated, "I am not a Jew. Do you believe me?" "Yes," I said. "I'm not a Jew either. I'm a gypsy. I'm glad I'm not a Jew." He walked to the nearest window and looked out. "Glad, are you?" "I think so," I said. "But sometimes I'm not sure. Jews get shot at and they have to ride horses backward and scrub the sidewalk with their beards. But I don't have a beard, and I think I might like to get painted." He was looking at me, but he didn't seem to see me. "Would you like some bratwurst?" I said. "We have bratwurst." I waited. At last he nodded. I went for the bratwurst. When I returned, the man was gone. When Uri and I walked the streets, I had strict instructions. I was to walk as if I knew where I was going. I was to look straight ahead. I was not to laugh or scream or dance or do anything to call attention to myself. "Be invisible," he said. "Like an angel?" I said. He ignored me. He said I was to look as if I had nothing to hide, as if I belonged there. "Most of all," Uri said, poking me in the chest, "don't look guilty." "What's guilty?" I said. "It's doing something you're not supposed to do." "That's easy," I said. I'm not guilty. I had forgotten about snatching Janina's birthday cake.
Fine, he said. Just don't look it.
I found a scrap of mirror. I looked into it. I practiced looking not guilty. I walked back and forth in the stable, looking straight ahead, looking as if I had nothing to hide. When we went outside, in the center of the city, among the crowds of people, I said to Uri, "Look!" and crossed the street by myself.
I held my head high. I looked straight ahead. I looked as not guilty as anyone ever looked, and as if I knew exactly where I was going. I got hit by an automobile. It was only a bump. The car screeched and stopped and hit me just hard enough to knock me off my feet. The driver was screaming, people were staring, and the next thing I knew, Uri was dragging me by the collar of my coat and at the same time kicking me in the rear, and the people were laughing. Uri wasn't laughing. He dragged me out of sight into an alley and dropped me like a sack of coal. He hissed in my face, "Did I tell you not to call attention to yourself, you stupid little turd?" I looked up at him. I nodded. Back to stupid. I had never seen him so mad. His hair looked redder than ever, only this time it was not because he was laughing. He punched me in the forehead. The back of my head banged against the wall. "Someday I am going to have to kill you to keep you alive." He flapped his arm. "You want to do it your way? You want to go off by yourself? Not listen to me? Go ahead!" He kicked me. "Go ahead!" He stomped off. By the time he reached the street, I was at his side. I was sure then that I would never again disobey Uri. But I did not know about the beautiful horses.
13. The first time I saw it was the time Uri first took me to the orphan's home. It was in a park within sight of the home. I couldn't believe my eyes. Horses going in a circle. I thought they were real. Then I saw they were not. They were made of wood, painted, going round and round to tootling music. I ran to them. I just stood there, overwhelmed. They were the most magnificent animals I had ever seen. Red horses, blue horses, horses of all colors, draped in gold and flowers, heads high, hooves raised as if prancing to the music. I barely noticed the children sitting on their backs. "What is it?" I said to Uri. "Merry-go-round," he said. The horses went round and round. As each wonderful horse went by, its large black eyes seemed to look straight at me. So proud and high were their heads, I saw for the first time how miserable were the real horses plodding the streets. Some of the children bounced and yelled, pretending to gallop. Others looked thoughtful. One was crying. Grown-ups stood watching. Someone pulled the crying child from her horse. I headed for it. Uri grabbed me. "No!" "Why?" I said. I tried to pull away. "It's not for you." I thought he was joking. "Everything is for me," I said, laughing. I believed it. He grabbed my neck in one hand. He squeezed until I couldn't breathe. He brought his face close to mine, his pickle breath. "No!" We turned our backs on the merry-go-round and went to the orphan's home. From then on, I went to sleep with the tootling music in my head. Gold-spangled horses circled my dreams. By morning, there was only straw in my ears. Whenever we went out together, I tried to steer Uri toward the merry-go-round. As we came near, I could always feel his hand slipping over my collar. I'm sure he knew I disobeyed him when I went out by myself. Many days I headed straight for the beautiful horses. But they were not always moving. "Electricity," Uri had once said, explaining why our light bulb used to work only sometimes when we lived like kings in the cellar of the barbershop. "It comes and goes." So it was even a grander treat to see the horses moving. I couldn't resist. The first day I went back alone, I was determined to ride a horse. There was a foot of snow on the ground, but I never felt the cold. Every gilded saddle was occupied. I stood watching them go round and round. I think my eyes must have been as big as the horses, my smile as wide as those of all the laughing children put together. And then the horses slowed down and came to a stop. And the music stopped, and the waiting people rushed forward and pulled the children from the saddles. I didn't wait.
I leaped onto the platform and onto a horse. It was the most beautiful of all the beautiful horses, and I had my eye on it from the start. It was as black as the coal dust under my fingernails. It had gold tassels behind its ears, and a flying tail, and three golden hooves on the ground, and one in the air. Its head was flung high, and its mouth was open, as if shouting to the horses of the world, "Look at me!" For those few moments, I was higher, I was grander than anyone. Then a child was screeching, "He doesn't have a ticket!" And a man came along and held out his hand and said, "Give me your ticket." And I said, "What's a ticket?" And the man yanked me from the horse and threw me face down into the snow. Within moments, a little girl with hair as gold as the horse's tassels stood above me pointing and screaming, "He's a dirty Jew!" I got to my feet. Everyone was staring at me, even the foxes on the shoulders of the ladies. I screamed back at her, "I am not!" I screamed at them all, "I'm a gypsy!" "Ew!" The golden-haired girl held her nose and kicked me and ran off shrieking. Other children tugged on the hands of the ladies like dogs on leashes. They flung their faces at me, "Dirty gypsy! Dirty gypsy!" One by one, the little girls were let go. They dashed forward, kicked me, and dashed back to the laughing ladies. Meanwhile, the boys bombarded me with snowballs. I ran, but I returned the next day, and the next. When the horses were moving, I stayed at a distance, watching, wishing. One time, when I brought coal to the nearby orphanage, I said to Dr. Korchak, "Do the orphans ride the merry-go-round?" Sometimes I saw the orphans play outside, but never near the merry-go-round. Something sad came over Dr. Korchak's face. "No," he said, "maybe someday." I looked up at his round face, at the fabulous white goatee. "Why not?" I said. "Because they're Jews?" He looked at the merry-go-round tootling behind me. He looked at the orphans playing nearby. Girls were jumping rope. He smiled at them, such a smile as I imagine must come from fathers. "They're children," he said. He sounded surprised. He looked down at me. "Children?" There was a question on his face, but I could not answer it. This thing, electricity, I did not understand it. It came and went without warning. I marveled that without it, lights were dark, the merry-go-round was still. For 2 or 3 days, the painted horses had not moved. I imagined I heard them screaming, "Let us run!" Then in the dark of the stable one night, I awoke to the sound of the music. Often in the night I heard the music. Uri explained that the music was only in my head, for the merry-go-round was 2 kilometers away. And besides, the merry-go-round did not turn at night. But this time it was different. The music was not in my head. I was sure of it. I went to the window. A full moon falling on the snow lit up the world. Who needed electricity? And somewhere out there music was playing. Uri slept. I sneaked out of the stable. Uri no longer tied me to himself, and into the curfew. The music got louder and louder as I came near the merry-go-round. I was right. I started to run. The snow slowed me down, and there it was, lit up by lights that I had barely noticed in the daytime. The music was tootling, the horses were going round and round, the lights were blazing, and no one was there. The mysterious electricity must have come on in the night and awakened the merry-go-round. I climbed onto the beautiful black horse with the golden tassels, and round we went. I went from horse to horse until I think I must have ridden them all. I rode them forward and backward. I rode them sitting down and standing up. I don't think I ever stopped laughing, and in the mix of my laughter and the music, I was sure I heard the whinnies of the horses, joyful to be moving again. And then a thought came to me. I stopped laughing. I looked at the dark hulk of the orphan's home. I jumped down from the merry-go-round. I wobbled and fell into the snow, dizzy from hours of riding in circles. I ran to the orphanage. I banged on the door. I called out, "Dr. Korchak! Dr. Korchak!" A light went on inside. Locks clacked. He opened the door. Fear was in his eyes. "Dr. Korchak!" I blurted. "The merry-go-round is going. Look, there's no one there. Bring the children." I took a step back. I waved, "Come on!" The doctor reached into the moonlight and hauled me roughly into the house. He slammed the door shut and bolted it. He shook me by the shoulders. He snapped, "Foolish, good-hearted boy." He hauled me upstairs to a bed. As I went to sleep in the orphan's home, the moon was going, morning was coming, and day was darker than night.
When I awoke, Ori was downstairs whispering with the doctor, their cloud breaths mingled. As we left the orphan's home, I waited for Ori to smack me, to knock my head into a wall, to call me stupid. He did nothing. He said nothing. As we walked through the snow, I looked up at him. If only he would squeeze my neck, make me cry. He did not even look at me. Then and there, I lost my desire to ride the beautiful horses, but not to look. 14. As the winter went on, the trees around the merry-go-round disappeared one by one, until soon there was nothing but stumps. And then the unthinkable happened. I was approaching the merry-go-round one day when I noticed that things were different. A great crowd was gathered around the platform, but there was no music, no movement. As I wormed my way through the crowd, I heard someone cry out, "A Jew did it!" I wondered what it could be that a Jew did. Then I saw. I couldn't believe my eyes. One of the horses was gone. Only three hooves remained. I had come to think of the horses as so real that for a moment I was surprised to see blonde, splintered wood instead of blood and bone where the legs had been chopped off. A scrap of surviving color told me the horse had been black. It was mine. My beautiful black and golden horse. "Find the Jew!" people were calling. As I stared at the three horseless hooves, I felt my own anger rising. "Find the dirty Jew!" the voices called over and over, and I think one of the voices I heard was mine. At the edge of the park, two jackboots stood talking and smoking cigarettes. They found the Jew. Or should I say they found a Jew. Jews were interchangeable. One was as good as another. I was to learn this many times. So, before the morning was over, a Jew came stumbling through the snow with a rope around his neck. He was led out to a clearing among the tree stumps. Someone noosed another rope around his neck. Someone else ripped off all his clothes. Until that moment, I had not noticed how cold it was. The man seemed to shrink, seemed to pucker into himself until all there was bulging eyes. The snow covered his ankles. "Make way! Make way!" someone growled. Two jackboots hauled a fat black hose through the crowd. They stopped 10 meters from the shrinking man of eyes and pointed the hose at him. Water leaped out. The hose flew out of the jackboot's hands and whipped wildly about like a sliced worm. People screamed and ran. The jackboots jumped onto the hose head and wrangled it down. They hugged it to themselves and again pointed it at the man. When the water struck him, he flew backward. The two ropes around his neck jerked him to a halt. The hose man backed off some more. Things settled down then, and the people gathered again. Some cheered and laughed and clapped. Some merely watched. I didn't think it was possible, but the man's eyes got even bigger. I could tell he was trying to shrink even more, to vanish completely. He never made a sound. When I walked away, he was turning blue. I did not return to the merry-go-round until the snow was gone and the grass was greening among the stumps. I wondered if the man had melted away like the snow. The three hooves were gone from the platform. The only reminder of what had happened was the empty space where the beautiful black horse had been. Otherwise, all was as always. The music was tootling, the ladies were laughing, the children were going round and round. 15. Autumn. The people were going. I had never seen so many people walking. We were standing on a street corner, watching. They were Jews. I knew by the armbands they wore. Every Jew had to wear a white armband with a blue star. This was a big help in telling who was a Jew, as they no longer wore beards. Until that moment, I had only seen a few Jews here, a few Jews there. I had not known there were so many. They came from many places, many streets, but they were all going in the same direction. Little children pulled wagons heaped high with toys and pots and books. Grown-ups pulled wobbling carts of furniture and clothes and pictures and rugs. It seemed they had emptied their entire houses into wagons and carts and the bulging sacks over their shoulders. Larger wagons were pulled by horses, smaller carts by people. The horses and the people looked alike, plodding, eyes to the ground, leaning forward against the weight of their loads. The horses did not wear armbands. Yet they, too, were clearly Jewish. It was a blue and white parade, and how different from the grand parade of the jackboots. So slow, so quiet, hardly a baby cried. The thump of a thousand jackboots was now the shuffle of ragged shoes. Instead of the roar of tanks, the crickety click of cartwheels. I shaded my eyes. "Where are they going?" I said to Uri. "The ghetto," he said. "What's the ghetto?" "Where the damned live." Though the people were quiet, there was much noise behind them. There was whistling and cheering and breaking glass. As the moving people came down out of their houses, other people rushed in. There were fist fights in the courtyards. People sailed from doorsteps. Top floor windows flew open. The new house people shouted over the heads of the walkers, "It's mine!" But I was more interested in this ghetto place, wherever it was. "Be back by curfew." It was all the warning Uri gave me anymore. I walked with the Jews. For a while I got carried away. Ever since the great jackboot parade, I had wanted to be in one. And so I marched along in a parade of my imagination, passing one plodding Jew after another, head high, arms swinging, goose-stepping as if I wore tall, shiny boots myself. If anyone noticed, I was not aware. No one said a word. Soon enough, my imagination petered out, and I slowed down to the pace of the others. I found myself walking beside a boy who looked Uri's age. The boy hauled a gray sack that bulged as if it held pumpkins. "Do you know Uri?" I said. The boy kept staring straight ahead. I repeated myself louder, "Do you know Uri?" The boy did not seem to know I was there. That didn't stop me. I was determined to talk. "Uri has red hair. He's not a Jew." I was always careful not to give Uri away. "Can I touch your armband?" He didn't respond. I touched it. "I'm a gypsy," I told him. "Maybe someday I'll get an armband too." I pulled a sausage from my pocket. I carried a sausage with me whenever I could find one. I snacked on it through the day. I held it up to him. "Would you like a bite of my sausage?" For the first time I saw his eyes move. Then the lady walking on the other side of him said, "He's not hungry. Please go." That was ungrateful, I thought, but I did as she said. I went from person to person, asking questions. "Are you going to the ghetto? Will you have a nice house in the ghetto? How much farther to the ghetto?" I never received an answer. To one and all, I offered my sausage, but no one took a bite. No one saw me, or so I believed, except the foxes on the shoulders of some of the ladies. Their tiny black round eyes stared endlessly at me. Once I saw a speckled mare.
"Greta!"
I cried out, and ran to her. But all she did was slobber over my head, and I knew it could not be Greta. I heard children singing, a familiar voice calling, "Old Man Goose, 1, 2, 3. I ran.
"Dr. Korchak!"
He staggered and laughed as I crashed into him.
"Dr. Korchak, are you going to the ghetto too?"
"Yes," he said. "We're all going." "Is it wonderful?" I asked him. He smiled. "We will make it wonderful." I marched with the orphans. They were singing. I did not know the words, so I just belted out sounds. When I was with them, I wanted to be an orphan too. Between songs came the clack and rattle of the carts and walking people. Once a voice came down from a high window, "Orphan pie!" And then I saw Janina. She was trudging along with her family. The sack over her shoulder almost fell to the ground. I ran to her.
Janina!
She looked at me. She smiled. Misha. I burst. Are you going to the ghetto? Where did you go? There's somebody else in your house now. I don't like him. He poured beer on my head. I smashed his foot. She laughed. I said it again. I smashed his foot. She laughed louder. Janina, I said. Nobody sees me except Dr. Korchak. A voice came. They see you. It came from the man walking behind us. The piled high cart he pulled was strapped to his shoulders. His was one of the faces I had seen around the birthday table. That's my father, said Janina. They don't look at me, I said to Janina's father. The cart behind him creaked and rattled. They're afraid of you, he said. I laughed. Nobody's afraid of me. Janina glared at me. Don't laugh at my father. If he says they're afraid of you, they're afraid of you. I looked up at him. Like everyone else, he stared straight ahead. His eyes were large and chestnut brown, like Janina's. Why are they afraid of me? I said. Before he could answer, Janina piped. Because you're not a Jew. Why do you think? I could not imagine such a thing. People afraid of me? I took out the sausage. Want a bite? No, came a woman's voice. But it was too late. Janina had snatched the sausage and ripped off a big bite. She handed it to her father. He looked at it for a while and finally took a bite. He held it out for the lady, but she shook her head. Another hand reached over and snatched it. This man finished it off. That's my Uncle Shepsel, said Janina. He lives with us. I reached for Janina's sack. I want to carry it. She gave it to me and at once went skipping ahead. I slung the sack over my shoulder. It wanted to pull me backward. What's in there? I called. Janina came skipping back. All my favorite things, except my scooter. Mama wouldn't let me bring my scooter. She glared at the lady. I pointed to her armband. Do you like it? I said. Tobias, said Janina's mother. Never mind, said her father. He's the boy. I know, the thief. Never mind. And then there was noise up ahead. The rattle of cartwheels grew louder. Come, come. Janina's father grunted and leaned into his harness until he was practically level to the street. The parade was going faster. Dropped pots rang like sick trolley bells. People were shouting. People were running. 16. A closet? Said Uri. A closet, I said. I footed a line in the dirt, dividing our stall in half. This big. That's what Uncle Shepsel said. We're living in a closet. I was telling him about the day. I told him how I met Janina and her family and that everyone rushed into the ghetto, and that was how I knew the ghetto must be a wonderful place. I told him how we went into a courtyard, a dirt square surrounded by high, flat walls of houses, and how Janina's father sent Uncle Shepsel, "Hurry! Hurry!" And Uncle Shepsel dashed into one of the houses and up the stairs, and Janina and I followed him, but I was last because of the sack. And Uncle Shepsel planted himself in a doorway on the fourth floor, and we planted ourselves too, until Janina's mother and father lumbered up. And we went back down and unloaded the cart, and carried the things upstairs. And some things needed two or three people to carry, but there was always one person left behind, planted in the doorway. And the house was a madhouse. That's what Janina's mother said, a madhouse, because so many other people were doing the same thing, and there was only one stairway, and someone was planted in every doorway. When everything was carried up, Janina's father and Uncle Shepsel broke apart the cart with hammers and kicks and carried the gray, splintery cart pieces up too, even the wheels. When everything was finally in, and Janina's father shut the door. That was when Uncle Shepsel said it. We're living in a closet. I told Uri what happened when I left. Janina wanted to walk down to the courtyard with me, but her mother said no. So she went with me to the landing outside the door, and then she said, "Wait," and went back inside. When she came out, she was grinning. "Close your eyes and hold out your hand." I did as she said. I felt something in my hand. Open. It was a piece of candy, a butter cream with a hazelnut heart. Except it was only half a candy. Even half the hazelnut was gone. I didn't know what it was until I bit it, she said. Then I saved it for you. I ate it. I hadn't had one in a long time. I had thought I would never taste another. She kept grinning. I ran down the stairs. When I returned to the ghetto, there was a wall in the way. Men were building it with bricks. It was 3 of me high. I walked along until I came to a section that had not yet been completed, where the wall was only a couple of bricks high. I stepped over. Someone yelled. I ran. Running wasn't easy because again I was carrying a large sack. This time the sack was filled with food. The harvest was in and the pickings were good for quick hands and feet. I found the house. It was on Niska Street. I climbed the stairs to the door. I knocked. A gruff voice said, "Who's there?" "Misha Pilsudski." I heard a squeal, then the rattle of locks. The door flew open. Janina threw up her hands. "Misha!" Janina's mother lay on a mattress in a corner of the room. She opened one eye and grunted, "You again?" "What's that?" said Janina, pointing to the sack. Uncle Shepsel slammed the door shut and locked it. "Food," I said. There was a square table in the middle of the room. I dumped out the sack. Janina clapped, "Food!" Turnips and apples rolled onto the table and off to the floor. There were bunches of carrots and celery and loaves of bread and jars of jam and molasses and bags of sugar and links of sausage. Everyone gathered around. Even Janina's mother got up from the mattress. "Where did you get it?" said Janina's father. "Many places," I said. Uncle Shepsel snapped a carrot in half, the smelly, nimble-footed thief. Janina's mother opened up a white, dusty bag. She dipped in a fingertip, tasted it. "This is baking powder. You need an oven to bake. Does he see an oven in here?" She returned to the mattress. She lay facing the wall. "I remember ovens. I had one." She coughed. "Once. I was a human being once." Uncle Shepsel looked at her with sad eyes. "Once upon a time." "There's a wall outside," I said. "Why is there a wall?" "Keep out the riffraff," said Uncle Shepsel with a sneer. "How did you get in?" Janina asked me. I told her how I found a low place in the wall and simply stepped over. I added, "I can go anywhere." I was not boasting, I was simply stating a fact. I had come to love my small size, my speed, my slipperiness. Sometimes I thought of myself as a bug or a tiny rodent, slipping into places that the eye could not even see. There was a knock on the door. Uncle Shepsel's finger flew to his lips. "Don't speak," he whispered. "We're not here." Then he sagged as Janina's father called out, "Who's there?" "Hiram Lefkowitz," came the answer. Janina's father unlocked the door. "Yes, come in." As Uncle Shepsel threw a coat over the food on the table, Hiram Lefkowitz came in. He took off his hat and held out a piece of paper. "Dr. Milgram." Janina's father took the paper. "I'm not a doctor." He went to a waist-high box-looking thing squatting on the floor and pulled at it. It opened up like wings. It was a chest with many little drawers. On either side of the chest were shelves of jars, some with powders, some with liquids of different colors. It reminded me of the barbershop. I wondered how the bottles had survived the rickety trek across the city. Janina's father took something from a drawer, put it into a little envelope, and gave it to the man. The man pulled an apple from his pocket. He looked about to cry. "I wish..." "Go," said Janina's father, ushering the man out. "No need. Go." The man reached back to touch Mr. Milgram. "Shalom. Shalom." Uncle Shepsel shut and bolted the door. He wagged a finger in the face of Janina's father. "By tomorrow, the whole place will know. We'll be overrun." Mr. Milgram pulled in the wings, and the chest of drawers became a plain-looking box again. "What would you like me to do? Save it all for ourselves?" "He gave me a prescription. I did my job." "There'll be nothing left in a week. They'll clean you out." Maybe we'll be out of here in a week.
If we're out of here, it will be in our graves.
He pointed out the one window.
You think they're putting up that wall only to last a week? We'll be lucky to ever get out of here, he was shouting.
Janina's mother groaned on the mattress. Janina and I were in a corner that would become our corner. My father is a pharmacist, she told me.
What's pharmacist?
I said. A pharmacist makes medicine.
What's medicine?
She looked at me strangely. Medicine makes people better when they're sick. It's like pills and castor oil, she made a face. Your father is Tobias Milgram, I said. She beamed.
Yes.
You are Janina Milgram.
Yes.
I am Misha Pulsotsky. She clapped her hands.
Yes.
Uncle Shepsel glared at us. Janina stuck out her tongue at him. I giggled. Not only did I have my very own last name, but now I knew someone else's. I giggled as if I were being tickled.
17. Suddenly everybody was living with Uri and me in the stable. Ines the grim-faced, Kuba the clown, Ferdy the smoke-blower, one-armed Oleg, shoeless Big Henrik, gray, unspeaking John, and others, boys no one seemed to know.
We stick out like purple turds, said Ines. He said that since the rest of the Jews went to the ghetto, the boys could no longer blend in with the street crowds. And there's finches everywhere.
What's finches? I said.
People that tell the jackboots where Jews are hiding.
I'm glad I'm not a Jew, I said.
He gave an ugly laugh. Don't worry. The ghetto is for you, too. I hear they take gypsies and cripples and crazies. If you want to be safe, be a cockroach.
There must have been a finch around, because one morning as we were sleeping in the hayloft, the door flew open and voices shouted.
We scrambled, like cockroaches, but jackboots were everywhere. One of the new boys jumped from the loft. He was shot in mid-air and flopped to the ground floor like a rag doll.
They marched us to the ghetto. Since they had finished the brick wall, topped with broken glass and coils of barbed wire, I had not been able to visit Janina. I took this as a personal insult and challenge. I had never before been kept out of any place I wished to be, and I had no doubt that I would soon find my way to the other side of the wall.
Still, I wasn't too proud to be grateful that the escorts were making it so easy. Something else occupied my mind even more along the march.
Uri. He wasn't with us.
When the jackboots rousted us in the stable, he wasn't there.
This was not surprising. In recent weeks, Uri was often gone, sometimes for days at a time. With his red hair and I belong here invisibility, Uri believed he would never be seen as a Jew. He was fearless on the streets. Also, he believed he was much smarter than the jackboots. I always knew when Uri was about to disappear. He would put his fist under my chin and whisper between clenched teeth, "Don't let me hear." He meant that he had appointed some of the boys to finch on me if I did something especially stupid and silly. I think he would have been surprised to know that I actually heeded his warning, as much as I was capable of heeding a warning. For some reason, I felt freer to be stupid and silly when he was there than when he was not. It never occurred to me to worry about Uri. I believed he knew everything and could handle anything, but, prodded along by the jackboots' rifles, I did wonder about him. Where was he? What was he doing? What would he think when he returned to find the stable empty? I did not wonder if he would find us. I knew he would. Instead of the sidewalk, the jackboots marched us down the middle of the streets. Horse wagons and automobiles made way for us. People stared. We're a parade, I thought. But for this parade, the people were not silent.
Bye-bye, you little snots. Over the wall with you, filthy Jews.
I didn't bother to tell them I wasn't a Jew. On one street, we marched down the trolley tracks, and here came a trolley heading right for us. We hesitated. The jackboots shouted. We continued. We did not stop. The trolley did. Then, with a clank and a clang, it began to move backward. And that was how we went down the street, the trolley backing up before us as we marched on. Soon we turned onto another street, and there was the wall. To the left and right, it went on forever in both directions.